Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. A suicide car bomber hit a European Union police training mission near Kabul's international airport on Sunday, killing three. The Taliban has claimed responsibility for the morning attack that took the lives of the British security contractor and two women bystanders. The blast wounded dozens more people on the streets and three others in the European mission police mission in Afghanistan in their vehicle. Yemeni political leaders met today in the Saudi capital of Riyadh to discuss a negotiated settlement to the ongoing conflict in that country. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
The conference opened in Riyadh with a traditional Yemeni folk dance as 400 top political leaders met to discuss the political crisis and military conflict raging in Yemen. The Houthi rebel group stayed away and demanded talks be held in a neutral country. Internationally recognized Yemeni President Abdrabu Mansour Hadi, he said the Yemeni people await stability, which can only come if the country's legitimate government and its institutions are restored and the Houthi rebels are disarmed. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Car bombings in the Iraqi city of Ramadi today killed 10 soldiers and policemen as the Islamic State tries to control the provincial capital where they raised their flag on Friday. In neighboring Syria, government troops reportedly pushed IS fighters back from Palmyra, leaving dozens dead and protecting a threatened UNESCO World Heritage Site. Egypt has hanged six men convicted of killing soldiers in 2014. The men hanged today in a Cairo jail were reported to be members of a Sinai-based militant group with ties to the Islamic State. Amnesty International called their trial unfair. This is VOA News. In spite of growing tensions over a territorial dispute in the South China Sea, Chinese President Xi Jinping says relations with the U.S. remain stable. Mr. Xi told visiting U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry earlier today he looks forward to his upcoming visit in the U.S. in September and believes that working together the two sides can bring U.S.-Chinese relations to a new height. Secretary Kerry has now moved on to Seoul, South Korea, where he will focus on security concerns in the region, around the world, and trade. The bodies of six U.S. Marines and two Nepalese soldiers who were aboard a Marine helicopter that crashed Tuesday in the earthquake-hit Nepal have been identified. The Nepalese search teams found the wreckage Friday, 3 days after it went missing during a relief mission to deliver rice and tarps to Cherkasy. The Prime Minister, Sushil Koirala, offered his condolences.
Our terrain is so difficult. That's why the American, that stopped us with that accident. That we feel so sorry for that, and we have sent our condolences.
Officials say teams from the U.S. military and Nepal's army are investigating what may have caused the crash to go down while it was delivering supplies to the area after a 7.8 magnitude earthquake struck Nepal on April 25th. Four nuns, including two Palestinians, are the Roman Catholic Church's newest saints.
Mariam Alfonsinam Danil Gatas et Mariam a Jesu Crucifixo Bawardi.
The Pope canonized them today at a Mass at the Vatican.
La Beata,
two of the nuns,
Alfonsa
Gattas and Mariam Abawadi, lived in what was then 19th century Palestine. Their canonization is seen as encouragement to Christians across the Middle East who are facing persecution by Islamic State extremists. They are the first saints from the Holy Land since the early years of Christianity, and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas attended the Mass in St. Peter's Square. A French nun, as well as an Italian nun, also became saints today. Meantime, Elizabeth Bing passed away the last few days. She is German-born and the founder of Lamaze International, co-founder, who popularized what is known as natural childbirth and helped women and doctors change the way they approach the bearing of children. She taught breathing and relaxation and that husbands should be involved as coaches. I'm Marty Johnson in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Corte in Washington.
The president had to come in order to know what is going to be the response from the security forces. And on another side, you see what are the responses that are being brought in by the regional leaders.
Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza makes first public appearance following an attempt to overthrow his government.
Cairo's criminal court issued death sentences to ousted Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi.
A former Egyptian president and other key supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood are sentenced to death. And some Ghanaian artists and civil society groups led a night vigil to protest against the ongoing erratic power supply in the country. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. President Pierre Nkurunziza was briefed by security officials on Sunday about possible security threats posed by the Somali-based Islamist terrorist group Al-Shabaab. Presidential spokesman Willie Nyamitwe says the president and his advisers discussed ways to combat the security threat to protect civilians. This after the terrorist group threatened to attack Burundi and neighboring Uganda. Earlier, I reached presidential spokesman Nyamitwe by phone for more on the security threat posed by Al-Shabaab.
There is a real threat that is coming from the Al-Shabaab, a terrorist one. But the government is taking this threat seriously. So the president was obliged to come on a Sunday in his office because he is seeking for a solution. What kind of response the government is going to bring in order to protect the country and the citizen. And as you know, this threat comes at a time when there are, in Burundi, rallies. One side of those who are campaigning, and on the other side, protesters against the candidacy of President Nkurunziza. So the president had to come in order to know what is going to be the response from the security forces. And on another side, you see what are the responses that are being brought in by the regional leaders in Uganda and Kenya. So he wanted to be briefed by his services at the president's office.
Where is the intelligence coming from about the possible threat of Al-Shabaab to attack Burundi and Uganda?
You know, in Burundi, we are in an electoral campaign. So we have rallies that are authorized by the law. And we also have, on another side, protesters against the candidacy of President Nkurunziza. But we saw a day before yesterday a statement from Al-Shabaab threatening to attack Burundi and Uganda. You know, Burundi is a contributor of troops. We've got around 6,000 soldiers on the ground in Somalia. So the threat is taken seriously by the government, and we don't know whether they are going to succeed or not, but we have to take some precautions and to know what is going to be the measures to take. So the president needs to be briefed by his services and his advisors this morning.
Talking about the election, is the president going to stand for the CNDD-FDD despite this ongoing protests?
You know, he's a candidate, but from the ruling party, not from his own. And the party has the right to appoint who it wants as long as the constitution is respected. So he remains the candidate from the ruling party, and he's going to campaign during the presidential campaign of June 2015. This is the decision from the ruling party, and this has to be respected if we are in a democratic country.
A lot of groups, including the African Union, called on the election to be postponed in order to create an atmosphere of peace and stability to organize credible elections. Will there be a consideration of postponing the election till things become normal in order to organize this election, or the election will proceed as originally scheduled?
You know, the government has no objection. Even the president has no objection. Because we have an electoral commission that is independent and that is a technical team. And it is that commission that has to check to see if the situation in Burundi is conducive for elections, because we need peaceful elections. But we let this electoral commission to let us know what is going to be the way forward. But we cannot, as a government, we cannot decide by ourselves as long as we have an electoral commission. So we are waiting for the electoral commission to respond to the request from the region, to respond from the request from the African Union and other partners.
What is the situation with the alleged coup plotters? I heard the ringleader, the coup leader, is still at large. What is the situation?
Yeah, some of them are still on the run, and the others surrendered themselves, while the others have been arrested by the police and the army. So some are being judged, and the others, when caught, they are going to be brought into in front of the court in order to be judged.
How was the president received after coming to the office for the first time following the attempted coup?
So, okay, when coming to Bujumbura from the countryside, he has been received by a very large cloud of Burundians who were happy to see him again. But on Sunday, coming from his palace to the president's office, so there was no cloud because no one knew he was coming to the office. Only journalists came to meet him.
Willie Nyamito is a spokesman for Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza. He spoke with me from the capital, Bujumbura. Some, but not all, of the leading opposition parties in the Democratic Republic of Congo say they want to take part in a national dialogue that President Joseph Kabila has announced he will be holding. For VOA, Nick Long has more from Goma.
President Joseph Kabila committed to holding a national dialogue when he signed a regional peace agreement at Addis Ababa in February 2013. He held what were called national consultations at the end of 2013, but some opposition parties did not take part. Last week, Mr. Kabila announced he will be holding a dialogue with political parties, civil society and the international community as the DRC prepares for elections. The timetable for elections is looking tight. Funding is not assured, the electoral roll is missing at least 5 million new voters, and the opposition claims the Electoral Commission will not be impartial. The opposition has been calling for dialogue on these issues, and President Kabila opened private discussions about the elections with three main opposition parties late last month. The biggest of those parties, the UDPS, or Union for Democracy and Social Progress, which claims it won the 2011 elections, will be attending the dialogue, says its spokesman in North Kivu province, Rubens Makindo.
Mais maintenant, aujourd'hui, il faut un véritable dialogue pour parler de vrais problèmes. Et quand j'ai dit de vrais problèmes, parce que
there needs to be a real dialogue, Makindo says, to talk about the real problems. He says President Kabila has agreed to talk about the problems that, as he puts it, tarnished the 2011 elections. That has to be discussed, he argues, so as to go forward to the next elections. Another of the three main opposition parties, the MLC of Jean-Pierre Bemba, who was convicted by the International Criminal Court and is currently in jail at The Hague, did attend earlier consultations but does not favour the dialogue. Eva Bazaiba is the MLC's national spokesperson.
De manière systématique, les recommandations de concertation ne sont pas appliquées. Qu'est-ce que nous apporte ce dialogue?
She says the recommendations from those consultations were not implemented, and so the MLC does not see the point in the dialogue. What we need are elections, she adds. The third opposition party that Mr. Kabila consulted, the UNC, Union for the Congolese Nation, does want the dialogue, says its North Kivu spokesman, Stéphane Mashukano.
Le dialogue doit être permanentement permanent, c'est-à-dire le dialogue en soi.
He says dialogue must be permanent and the UNC will be faithful to its political line of never betraying the Congo or its people and respecting the constitution. One of the big unknowns in Congolese politics has been whether President Kabila would try to change the constitution to run for a third term. The ruling coalition is divided on that issue. UDPS spokesman Makindo suggests this is why Mr. Kabila agreed to a dialogue.
Nous avons compris que dans son propre camp, il se pose aussi un problème.
We can see, he says, that in Kabila's camp there are also problems, and they have realized the need to meet with the real political forces. Congo researcher Hans Hoberger, who works for the International Crisis Group, commented on why President Kabila might now want a dialogue.
Il y a pas mal de rumeurs que ceci pourrait être lié aux intentions du gouvernement.
There are quite a few rumors, he says, that this could be linked to a plan by the government to have another reshuffle following the one last December.
Donc on l'a décrit aussi dans notre rapport, on peut se poser la question à certains moments, c'est quoi la majorité?
He says it's difficult to guess at the government's intentions, but the dialogue might be, as some people say, an attempt to divide the opposition. With both opposition and ruling coalition uncertain about their own supporters and their own leadership, it remains unclear what results the dialogue will have. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
And in news from North Africa, ousted Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi and a number of top leaders of the now banned Muslim Brotherhood group were given death sentences in one of several cases against them. The cases were referred to Egypt's Grand Mufti, the country's top religious leader, to either approve or commute the sentences. For VOA, Edward Uranian reports from the Egyptian capital, Cairo.
Cairo's criminal court issued death sentences to ousted Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi and 105 co-defendants Saturday in a case known as the Wadi Natroun jailbreak. Mr. Morsi and other prisoners fled the Wadi Natroun prison, allegedly with help from outside groups, during the January 2011 uprising against former President Hosni Mubarak. Mr. Morsi was seen on Qatari-owned Al Jazeera TV speaking on a borrowed satellite phone during the early days of the 2011 uprising, telling the TV service that he had broken out of prison with a number of other defendants.
إرسال أوراق القضية إلى فضيلة مفتي الجمهورية.
The Cairo court also issued a separate verdict against several top Muslim Brotherhood leaders, including the group's deputy guide, Khairat Shatter, and Brotherhood figure, Mohammed Baltaghi, for conspiring with the Hamas and Hezbollah groups in organizing the prison break. Egyptian media reported that three judges were killed in the northern Sinai town of El-Arish Saturday after the minibus in which they were riding came under fire. The attack took place immediately after the verdict against former President Morsi and his co-defendants. Amateur video showed Mr. Morsi smiling at onlookers from behind a protective glass cage after the verdict was announced. The video also showed other top Muslim Brotherhood leaders making a four-fingered salute to symbolize the violent breakup of a protest camp in northern Cairo in August 2013, which left over 600 people dead. The verdicts announced Saturday will be reviewed by Egypt's Grand Mufti, the country's top Islamic cleric, and his decision will be announced on June 2nd. That decision may also be appealed, setting the stage for a lengthy review process before any final verdict is reached. Maha Hazem, a Brotherhood leader in exile, wrote on the group's website that the death sentence against Mr. Morsi was handed down in a farcical trial that has no legitimacy. Amnesty International also condemned the series of trials, calling them a charade.
Saeed Sadek, a well-known Egyptian political sociologist, tells VOA that Saturday's verdicts are only preliminary and that the Egyptian judicial system has a long system of checks and balances before coming up with any final decision.
All court verdicts by criminal courts are preliminary, and there is appeal, automatic appeal by the defendant. So there would be appeal on the side of Morsi and the other defendants. So the case is not over yet. It will take a long time. But a court verdict is a court verdict, and you would have to go through the legal process to overturn it.
Sadek went on to argue that Egypt's president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, has the authority to commute the sentences, but that he doubted the president would intervene at this stage in the judicial process. Paul Sullivan, who teaches at Georgetown University, argues that the political tug-of-war between the Muslim Brotherhood and the Egyptian government was poisoning the climate in the country, and that it was time for the Brotherhood to back down and allow Egypt to move forward towards peace and prosperity. Despite the long and uncertain judicial process, those defendants condemned to death, including Mr. Morsi, will now have to wear red prison garb to symbolize their death row status. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Going to West Africa, some Ghanaian artists and civil society groups led a night vigil Saturday to protest against the ongoing erratic power supply, locally termed Dumso. The groups say the government has yet to resolve the power situation in the country, despite repeated promises. Francis Akwey was at the vigil and joins us live via telephone link up in the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Good evening, Francis.
Good evening, Peter. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Now, Francis, wonderful. Francis, let me ask you, was the objective of the vigil achieved?
Definitely. I think the objective for this Dumso vigil has been widely achieved, because the main purpose was for us to put pressure on government to find lasting solutions to the persistent power cuts that have bedeviled this nation for the past 3 years and counting. As a matter of fact, to be fair to this government, this power cut started sometime in the 2000s, the early 2000s, but it has become more crippling in the past 3 years. So ours was to go down and vent our frustrations on the streets and put the government on its toes so that they find lasting solutions to this problem.
Well, critics of the whole vigil say that the vigil lacks credibility, since two of the main organizers wouldn't even attend the event. What's your take?
That's funny. That's very, very funny. One, the main organizer, Yvonne Nelson, who is a movie actress, was part and parcel. Actually, Sarkodie, who was also the partner, had to be in America doing a collaboration with Acewood. So he couldn't be here physically, but he sent word via social media that he was with us in spirit. Actually, he released a Dumso song for Joe. So that is laughable. That is laughable.
Now, supporters of the government are saying that this whole, you know, pressure group or this whole thing is just doing the dirty work of the main opposition party to embarrass the government and make it unpopular, especially ahead of the next general election. So my question to you is, are you part of the team that seeks to make the government unpopular?
Well, there are lives that have been lost in the last 3 years, all right? There are times when we go to medical centers and because of power outages, surgery cannot be done and people have lost their lives. There are times where properties have been lost because there were no lights in the evening and robberies have escalated. Lives and properties have also been lost. Businesses are crippling. Businesses are shutting down because they don't have power to produce. Workers are being laid off. And if I have to be a part of this group, all right, to voice my outreach at government, and it was seen by government being opposed to them, then I think it's for a just cause. So my conscience is clean.
Now, Danah Tudazi, a prominent member of the ruling party, one time a chief of staff, and other supporters of the ruling party say the criticisms against the government are unjustified because, as you rightly put it, the erratic power supply, or the Dumso, as people term it in Ghana, started from a military regime under General Kutu Achampong, and that these criticisms are unjustified because the government is doing all it can to increase power production, among other engagements that it's doing to improve the living conditions of the average Ghanaian. You doubt that? Why?
I strongly disagree with Nana Atudazi. Actually, it might be true that it started from General Kutu Achampong, but does it mean that we have to sit down and settle with this mediocrity? No, we are saying no. It has to stop at a point, all right? In the 2000, Dumso started, and I think the Kufuor government started some projects. Exactly, the Bui Dam project was brought on, and this government also inherited a Bui Dam project and did some works on it. But for the past 3 years, our president has been promising us promise upon promise that this Dumso will stop. Actually, the last promise was last year, December, that after last year, 2014, Dumso will be no more. And after December, Dumso is worse. Ministers have promised and failed. In last April, they promised us some power budgets were being thrown in to provide power so that this Dumso will be done with. But come April, there were no side of budgets. Actually, it came to light that the government has not even contracted anybody to bring in budgets.
Thank you very much. That was Francis Akwey, who was at the night vigil to protest against the erratic power supply in Ghana. He joined us from the capital, Accra. And in Uganda, electoral reforms being proposed, especially on how best to constitute an independent electoral commission, might not be in place by the next elections. Many activists are now expressing frustration about government reluctance to adopt the reforms. Father Gaetano Batanyenda is the chairperson of the Interreligious Council in Kekezi sub-region and an activist for electoral reforms. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached him in Kabale and asked him if he still thinks there's a chance for these reforms.
If our leaders know their role as leaders, know their duty as being that of respecting the people of Uganda, because according to the Constitution of Uganda, all power belongs to the people of Uganda, okay? And the people shall express their will and consent on who shall govern them and how they should be governed, through regular, free, and fair elections of their representatives or through referenda. Now, if our leaders are there for the good of the people, and if they know that the power belongs to the people, surely there is no way how they should say no to these proposed electoral reforms. These electoral reforms are not made or are not from a few individuals. It is the people of Uganda. You know, this exercise took us almost 6 months traveling all over Uganda, gathering the views of the people. Then we assembled in Kampala Hotel Africana. Then we made a compact. So this is a compact that was presented to the speaker, but the government is not willing to accept the compact for the reasons best known to themselves. Because they know that if things are according to the wish of the people, most of them, they will not be where they are. So, definitely, I have got hope up to now that any serious Ugandan, any serious leader should interject these good proposals, which are patriotic and for people.
Now, Father, if these reforms proposed are not implemented, do you expect a free and fair elections come next year?
How can it be free and fair? Otherwise, if we knew that because we made these proposals basing ourselves on the past experiences, surely if we are watching next week some members of the public. Fortunately, we got a letter. I've just come from Kampala. We got a letter from the secretary to the parliament, inviting people with proposals.
That was Father Gaetano Batanyenda, chairperson of the Interreligious Council in Kigezi Sub-Region and political reform activist. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Kabale, Uganda. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's go to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, May 17th. The playoff stage of the 2015 African Confederation Cup kicked off across the continent this weekend. The eight winners of the Confederation Cup second round were drawn against the eight losers of the Champions League second round. The eight aggregate winners will advance to the group stage of the Confederation Cup, Africa's second-rated club football competition. On Saturday, all the four first-leg matches ended in the same 2-0 scoreline. CS Faxien of Tunisia defeated visiting ASEC Mimosas of Ivory Coast. Stade Malien of Mali beat visiting AS Vita Club of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Orlando Pirates of South Africa traveled to Guinea to defeat home team AS Kaloum, while host Raja Casablanca of Morocco beat Etoile du Sahel of Tunisia. Four more matches are due to be played today, Sunday, in the first leg. Return leg matches are due to be played on the weekend of June 5th to 7th. Same with African football. Nigeria has named its final team for this year's FIFA Under-20 World Cup due to kick off in New Zealand at the end of the month. According to the team list released by Manu Garba, head coach of Nigeria's Flying Eagles, as the country's national under-20 team is known, skipper Musa Mohamed will lead the team. Others include Taiwo Awoniyi, Kelechi Iheanacho, and Success Isaac, all members of the Nigerian team that won the FIFA Under-17 World Cup in the United Arab Emirates in 2013. At the Under-20 tournament, African champion Nigeria will play its first match against Brazil on June 1st, before taking on North Korea and Hungary in Group E. Nigeria has never won the FIFA Under-20 World Cup since the competition started in 1977, but the country has twice clinched the silver medal at the two yearly tournaments. Apart from Nigeria, other teams that will fly the African flag in New Zealand are Ghana, the only African team to have won the FIFA Under-20 tournament, Mali and Senegal. Away from Nigeria, an Egyptian court on Saturday banned the country's hardcore soccer fan clubs, known as the Ultras, over terrorism accusations. The Ultras took part in protests during and after the 2011 uprising and frequently clashed with police in and around stadiums. The ruling by the Court of Urgent Matters in Cairo, the Egyptian capital, appeared to be the latest effort by the judiciary to prevent demonstrations. During the 2011 uprising that forced out President Hosni Mubarak, the Ultras played a major role. The court's ruling followed a case filed by Murtada Mansour, the head of the Zamalek Football Club, one of Egypt's most popular teams. Mansour has long been at odds with his team's Ultras organization, known as the White Knights. Last month, 11 fans were sentenced to death in a retrial of over 70 defendants accused in the 2012 soccer riots that left 74 people dead. Since the 2012 stadium violence, authorities have sharply limited attendance at matches. At least 19 people were killed in February when police fired tear gas into a crowd of fans trying to attend the match. Many of the dead suffocated or were crushed. And from Rwanda comes the report that military team APR has won the 2014-2015 Rwanda Football Premier League with one match to spare. On Friday evening, APR played 2-2 with Isonga in the penultimate match. APR's 52 points from 25 matches have guaranteed the title, as there are 6 points between the top team and the second-placed AS Kigali. The latest victory brings to a record 15 the number of league titles that APR has won. The club will represent Rwanda in next year's CAF Champions League. Finally, President Sepp Blatter of World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, has opposed plans to expand the number of teams at the World Cup. He says he would like to keep the number of participants at the four-yearly soccer extravaganza to 32 if he is re-elected. Blatter is standing for a fifth mandate as FIFA president on May 29th. Two of his three challengers have said he will expand the World Cup to at least 40 teams. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Klote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Uncle. The tomorrow.
Sichalosi, so Sichalosi, the boss, Sichalosi.
Le propriétaire de tous les dossiers. Avec la participation de Jocelyne Berroa.
Allez, allez, sous-couvre.
Bagisa.
Our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. There was much coverage last week regarding the tragic developments in Burundi. President Pierre Nkurunziza and his band of ardent supporters continue to willfully reject all national, sub-regional, regional, and international appeals for reconsideration of the third-term ambition. Now, after the crushing of a premature coup d'etat, the president and his supporters have convinced themselves that they have prevailed by triumph or force of arms, and the president yesterday called on all Burundians to accept the fact that he has prevailed and to cease all protest against his third-term ambitions. But this could be a Pyrrhic victory, and it is illusory for the president to believe that once he has suppressed the coup d'etat, his opponents will roll down and accept normality for him to proceed with third-term appeal. We know that the civil society groups have announced that tomorrow they plan to resume their protest against the president's ambition. Do this with great risks to their life and limb. The United Nations have expressed concern of the possibility of repercussion against those who protest against the president. And the African Union and the regional groups, along with the Peace and Security Council of the AU, were correct to denounce the coup d'etat as the means by which to institute a government in Burundi. This has been a long-standing principle of the AU. Now, the AU, the United States, United Nations and the rest of the international community must be robust in letting President Nkurunziza know that he could not give a diktat to the international community and that there will be grave consequences if he proceeds on his bid. Now, there are no possibilities under these conditions for any elections to be held that will be free, fair, and on an equal footing. That is why the AU and other governments have called for the postponement of the elections. But there is no guarantee that the president and his supporters will accept it. Mercifully, the crisis in Burundi has not been along ethnic lines given the tragic history of that country. Even the man who led the coup is a Hutu general and a man who worked with the president but was courageous enough to warn him that it would be illegal for him to go for a third term, something which led to his dismissal. Now, there are governments, there are presidents in Africa watching to see how this matter will end. This is why it is very important that the consequences for the president to proceed should be made clear to him. And the Belgian government has already withdrawn all the funds for the elections. I think other governments should make clear that sanctions will also be imposed on the government. We are now poised in a situation where unless firm action is taken, we are faced with the institution of authoritarianism in Burundi instead of reviving the democratic rule which has brought peace and security to that country. I thank you.
Thank you very much. That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Segun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov. We say thanks for joining us. And as the elders say, when there is a cotton wool in your backside, you don't jump over a raging fire. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is concerned about the treatment of political prisoners in Belarus. On May 4th, former presidential candidate Nikolai Statkevich was sentenced to harsher prison conditions and increased security measures for alleged violations of prison rules. Mr. Statkevich is serving a 6-year sentence related to his participation in peaceful protests following the December 2010 presidential elections. The United States is also concerned by the April 30th denial of Mikolai Ziadok's appeal of a February court decision that extended his prison term by 1 year for alleged prison rules violations. Mr. Ziadok was scheduled to be released in March 2015. In response to international pressure, President Alexander Lukashenko's government has released some political prisoners. For example, between January and September 2011, and again in August and September 2012, Belarusian authorities released, pardoned, or reclassified the offenses as less serious for several of the detainees facing riot charges from events following the December 2010 election. According to the Department of State's annual country reports on human rights practices and non-governmental organization reports, many of them had to admit guilt as a condition of their release. In April 2012, Belarusian authorities released former opposition presidential candidate Andrei Sannikau and his aide, convicted in connection with the peaceful protests in 2010. But according to the State Department and NGO reports, once released, such individuals remain subject to police supervision, and their civil and political rights are not fully restored. Some have also been forbidden, without explanation, from leaving Belarus. The United States renews its call on the government of Belarus to release all political prisoners immediately and unconditionally, and to restore fully their political and civil rights.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.